Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002. Goes out every Friday afternoon at 2 p.m. on BCFM 93.2. This week we look at a campaign to change the money system. About time too, isn't it? With John Long. Plus our weekly news and some disabled people's update with Jason Yannakopoulos. More too with Peruvian-born genius documentary filmmaker Alan Frankovich. And of course, the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. Dialect recommends the volunteer-run Bristol Bully Watch helpline, aimed mainly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753. And we'll have a reminder of phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. But I'm joined, first of all, by John Long. Hi, John, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, you're a recovering alcohol drug abuse person. Now, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, it means that, well, I'll just briefly explain. I worked in the sort of global banking industry for many years. And like many other people working in high-stress professions and work, I ended up starting to drink quite a bit too much.
What were you actually doing, John, from day to day? Was it long hours? And
it was long hours. Yeah, I was working in the IT industry, and I was designing and selling very large data warehouses, analytical systems to some of the biggest banks in the world, people like Royal Bank of Scotland and Citibank. And
what did this software actually do then?
Well, it was basically decision support software to enable banks to work out how to cross-sell and resell, upsell more and more debt to their customers worldwide, and to supposedly analyse the risk of doing that.
So there's a bit of bad karma comes with that, doesn't it, really? Because the idea is that, I mean, the banks will be using that software basically to fleece people, won't they?
Yeah, well, they're certainly using the software to aggressively sell more and more debt to people who were highly susceptible to buying it, in the knowledge that they were probably had a fairly addictive lifestyle already, and that they would be suckers for high cost unsecured and secured debt. So it was morally dubious. There was a fair amount of moral hazard involved in it, that's for sure.
Okay, and so how did the drugs and the drink, how did that come in?
Well, I think there was a sort of gap between what I thought I knew was right and what I was actually doing. And the rewards of doing it were greater and greater, as I moved from being sort of into regional sales and marketing management for these systems, into sort of national sales and European sales and then global sales. And the systems got bigger and bigger and more complex. And the rewards for selling them to bigger and bigger banks, who were prepared to take bigger and bigger risks and use these machines in more and more morally dubious ways, was tremendous.
One of the things that we hear now quite a lot is that, there has been and probably still is in the City of London a quite a law-breaking culture. Would you say that the sort of moral hazard that you're going through with what you were selling, and the idea that actually maybe this was a little bit going a bit too far, actually went along with the breaking the law and the drug taking?
Yeah, I'm sure it did. I think it did. I think the moral bar gradually gets lower and lower as the amount of money you're generating increases exponentially. So there's an inverse relationship between your morality and the amount of money you're making.
And what point did you realise, look, I'm going to have to do something about this?
Basically when the police arrived. That was the point at which a barrister suggested that it might be quite a good idea to pretend that
so
I was
in
recovery.
So how did that happen, and where were you?
I was working in London at the time that they arrived, and my wife took the rap for what happened, And
so was that the Met or City Police or what?
Regional Drug Squad. And that was a wake-up call. That was a moment of clarity when I got a phone call from a friend of mine at sort of 9 o'clock in the morning, saying I could hear at that stage my kids were 21 and 17, and I could hear them sort of crying in the background. And that was a wake-up call. And I've been trying to stop and do something about all of these issues for a long time. But yeah, that was the start of a journey, for sure.
Well, that journey has led you through into this recovery from drugs and alcohol, yeah, and now towards something very positive, which, yeah, is this Positive Money campaign.
That's right.
Tell us about that and how you first came across Positive Money.
I first came across Positive Money when I'd... I got several friends by this time who were Quakers, and I'd become interested in money theory and large systems in any case. My dad was a civil defence planner in the 1960s, and he was involved in very big systems, and I was fascinated by big systems.
So does money come into civil defence then? I suppose it might do. Yeah. I mean, if you're talking, yeah, about the breakdown of order in a country, then, yeah, money is possibly part of that, isn't it?
Yeah, creating long-term sustainable systems is part and parcel with systems thinking on both sides of the fence, you know, whether you're on the sort of reform side or on the side of looking at long-term ramifications of the possibility of a breakdown of civil society, you know, how you actually create a sustainable money system as systems become more volatile and turbulent is very interesting.
Well, it sounds like you could be a real benefit to this Positive Money campaign as someone who's come right from the inside to see exactly what's wrong with the way it's currently working or not working.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people within Positive Money who've come from the banking industry anyway, who've been able to see the banking industry and the way it operates and the way the money system operates and know that it's parasitic and dysfunctional and completely
out of kilter, it sounds like Positive Money is almost like a rehab stop, yeah, for yeah, ex-bankers. Or
yeah,
whatever.
Absolutely. Yeah, it certainly is, you know. And I think that's true. I think there's a lot of us congregating to the campaign because, you know, we've had a lot of insight over many, many years about how dysfunctional and destructive the current money system is. And it's been widely known that there is a solution, you know, that the economic theories that were developed after the recession in the 1930s were perfectly valid in terms of designing different money systems and testing them, you know, and there have been lots of precedents where alternative money systems have been tried and tested and works perfectly successfully. You know,
so, okay, so as someone who's been on the inside, what's wrong with the present system and how does Positive Money plan to fix it?
Basically, what's wrong with the present system is that the system we have at the moment is debt-based money. So for every pound that's in circulation, somebody, somewhere, has got to be in a pound's worth of debt. And that's how the current system operates. That's certainly true of 97% of the money, the digital money.
So, I mean,
I've got
a few pound coins in, yeah, my pocket. Well, who's got the debt for that then?
Well, the pound in your pocket, the actual physical money, only accounts for like 3% of the money in the total economy. The 97% of the money is digital money that's created by private banks.
Okay, so you're talking about maybe the actual money in my account?
Yes.
Assuming I've got some positive, I haven't checked it, yeah, today. I'm not in the red. So the positive number in there, yeah, someone somewhere is holding that as debt. I don't quite,
correct,
understand that. Explain that.
Well, basically the way it works is that in order for money to get into the circulation in the current system, somebody's got to borrow some money to get it into existence. So when a bank makes a loan, particularly say a mortgage, it literally is creating that money out of nothing by creating a debt. And that is effectively how money gets into circulation.
So hang on. So the bank is creating the money out of nowhere.
Correct.
So it's pressing a little button on a computer screen.
Absolutely.
And, God, that's actually quite a privilege. I'd quite like to have that, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, of course, it's interesting that the last regulations governing the creation of money by banks were actually in 1844 by a Tory government. And what was happening then was that the private banks were creating paper money. And it was creating an enormous amount of inflation in the economy. And so an enlightened Tory government could clearly see this as having a detrimental effect on inflation, particularly property price inflation, and introduced legislation to prevent the banks from creating money out of nothing. Unfortunately, as they didn't foresee the advent of digital money. Yeah, so in 1844, the Tories introduced a law to prevent private banks from creating money out of nothing, to prevent rampant inflation in the economy, particularly a property price bubble in that case. And that worked very successfully, of course, until the banks found a way of creating digital money out of nothing, which is what they're doing now. But that's never been properly regulated. And so what we've ended up with is an out-of-control money supply system where the private banks can create money out of nothing, create a huge glut of money as they did in 2006, 2007, where there's an enormous amount of additional money going into the economy.
I mean, I can remember, even though I was signing on, going into my bank and having one of the cashiers saying, how much do you want to borrow?
Absolutely.
Unbelievable, really. I mean, they were apparently had targets of amounts of money that they were trying to lend. I mean, I took the mickey and said, well, actually, what I really want is a nice sports car, and that's going to be about £60,000-£70,000. You know, can I borrow that? And she went away to check.
Exactly.
Even though I'm on the dole, the idea of borrowing 60-70 grand, she actually came back and said, no, you can only borrow 30,000.
Yeah.
I thought, even so, a ridiculous amount of money.
Ridiculous amounts of money. And of course, what the banks were doing at that stage is they're offloading all of the risk onto these collateralized debt vehicles that were then handed off to someone
else. This is what they call derivatives, isn't it?
Exactly right. And that's
so the derivatives, it seems, are really part of the problem. The idea that you can shoulder, you know, push the debt, the risk away, so you don't have to actually shoulder that risk, is quite a pernicious idea, isn't it, really?
It's absolutely pernicious, and that creates moral hazard. So the banks are then machines that are simply creating debt and money out of nothing based upon reckless lending, which they're then offloading to someone else who doesn't really have a clear view of what they are buying. And of course, the function of large-scale analytical systems and data warehousing was to provide some sort of spurious justification to explain the complex risk models and algorithms that have gone into these collateralized derivatives.
Yeah, I suppose I can almost imagine it now. You know, the bankers explaining this and all the people kind of glazing over with all these formulae.
Precisely.
And thinking, oh, well, okay, well, it must be safe.
It must be safe because we've got the best boffins in the world. We've got real rocket scientists designing
They're probably
these
very
systems.
Well-dressed, nice suits and
Precisely.
Everything. You know.
Everybody's well-dressed and wearing a nice suit and all being terribly polite to each other. But it's
bought on money made up out of nowhere.
Absolutely
probably.
Right. Precisely, yeah.
Gosh. So, it sounds horrendous. Anyway, carry on.
Yeah, and so that's effectively how the system is operating. And so clearly, you know, we need to get to a system. If we're going to have a sane and sustainable money system, we need to get to a point where there's some sane and democratic control over the amount of money in the economy. Because what happens now is you get a huge explosion of the amount of money in the economy, followed by a complete absence of money in the economy, which is what we're seeing now. So it becomes impossible.
I've seen the graphs,
John.
Yeah. If you look at the actual graphs of the national debt, it's going up logarithmically. It's going up. You know, they talk about the deficit. Oh, well, this is, you know, we've got to get the deficit down. Now, the deficit is really just a ratio of the amount of money that's being spent and the amount of money that's being borrowed.
Yeah.
Actually, that isn't really changing.
No,
you know,
no.
It's still, we're spending far more than we're actually getting in taxes. So, you know, we aren't really changing anything. It's almost like looking at, you know, the car is still going much too fast, even though it's maybe not accelerating as fast as it was or accelerating. You know, it's a very peculiar the way it's being explained to us, I think.
Yeah.
You know, this whole business of the deficit. I mean, what are your thoughts about that? Because having seen that graph, it scares me. I mean, it's going up at an incredible rate, this national debt. We're never going to be able to pay it off. That's quite clear.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. But of course, what the critical question is, who do we owe all this money to? You know, one of some of the fascinating statistics are, if we paid back for all of the debt with all of the money that's in the economy, we'd still owe the banks 320 billion quid, you know.
So we could never, ever pay that. Even if they said, right, we're having all the money back, it wouldn't be possible to pay it.
Absolutely right. Right. I mean, it's absolute nonsense to say that that's a viable solution to the problem.
Well, it's nice to think there's people like Positive Money around that have thought about this and are thinking about a way forward. So what is that?
Well, basically what Positive Money is suggesting is that we need to get away from a system of money creation that's based on debt. So the proposal is basically to introduce a system whereby the central bank create money, just as they did in 1844, and we re-establish democratic control over the money supply. We have something called a money creation policy committee that would determine how much money is in the economy. We would create money based on the fact that it needs to be a public utility, and we would have systems and processes in place to put real money into the real economy.
So there would be no excuses anymore, we don't have enough money to keep the hospitals running.
Precisely.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Because that money would then just be created. But I mean, the argument is always, look, you may get runaway inflation in that sort of situation if the government is just able to print money as much as it wants to. Isn't that a feasible
Absolutely
argument
not true.
Against what Positive Money are suggesting?
No, I mean, this money system was introduced in Pennsylvania in the 1720s, and it worked perfectly well. You know, it's perfectly feasible for a state to create money and to create enough money to sustain real economic performance and real economic activity in an economy. Well, the lobbying interests of the banks would let us believe, you know, they're spending £90 million a year lobbying.
Well, I mean, we bailed them out, didn't we? Well, exactly, so that they've got even more money to spend on lobbying.
Precisely. But of course, you know, the fact that they're creating money, that they have the right to create money at 6% interest on all the money that's created in the economy, is a massive, massive subsidy to the banks. That's the primary source of income in terms of retail banking in the UK, comes from the fact that they're able to create money out of nothing.
So, I mean, the idea of Gordon Brown's to nationalise some of the big banks, RBS, Lloyds, these kind of people, theoretically is a good one, but it doesn't look as if he's actually, or, you know, subsequent governments have actually used that shareholding and that power to appoint and really direct those banks and what they do. We keep hearing, don't we, through this quantitative easing and printing money, that there's massive amounts of money going into these banks, it's just not managing to find its way through the bank and into the economy.
Correct.
And it's very, very difficult for people to borrow money now.
It's very, very difficult for people to borrow money. And of course, the banks have lost the ability over 20 or 30 years to actually assess risk for business lending. But there was a time 20, 30 years ago when the banks were relatively good at assessing risk for business lending because that was the mainstay of their business. But the mainstay of their business simply became selling debt as secured loans on property. So all we ended up with was a massive, massive increase in the money supply and a hugely inflationary cycle in terms of property prices.
Yes, it's a bubble.
So the reason property prices have risen by 200% in 10 years is because there's been a 370% increase in the money supply. Okay. And most of that money is secured lending on mortgages.
Okay, so what about a transition, though, between the current system and a positive money type system where you've actually got the Treasury manufacturing, creating money and spending it straight into the economy, or directly.
It wouldn't be the Treasury, it would be the Bank of England. So the Bank of England would be putting money directly into the economy. You'd have a central, and they would be so all money would be created by the Bank of England, effectively, or by a central bank. The transition from the system we've got now to that system isn't particularly hard. What you then do is take the BACS system, which is the system for payments, and you transfer money that's currently in current accounts, is transferable, but would then be called transaction accounts. And so those transaction accounts are effectively accounts that are used purely and simply for the transaction of current, or, as the name suggests, of transactions. You then separate out completely investment banking, and you would introduce savings accounts, which would be specifically where if you wanted to take some risk on your savings, then you could engage in some risk-based saving. But you'd then have to have a system where you'd have complete discretion in terms of where that money was going to be invested. At the moment, that's an opaque system. So if I put money into HSBC or, you know, any retail bank at the moment, I've got no way of knowing what they in turn are going to do with that money in terms of how it's going to be invested or whether it's going to be ethically invested, for example. And clearly, that's a big issue as well. So we want to get to a point where there's democratic control over the money supply, where we can control the amount of money which is going into the real economy, where that money isn't being created out of nothing as reckless lending by banks, and a simple system of ensuring that the back system is effectively controlled purely as a transaction engine, which is perfectly feasible. The actual costs of running a current account work out at about £5 a month. You know, so you might end up with a system where you might have to pay £5 a month to run your current account, but it's a small price to pay for having a sustainable banking system and real money in the real economy.
The banks are never going to let you do this, are they? They're much too powerful. Mm. They've also, many people would say, they bought the political parties. You've got to get this through the political system that the banks own. They're never going to let you do it.
Exactly. And you could argue that we've got a supine, captured state in terms of the way in which political parties and the political system works at the moment. But I do think that if you can campaign on this one single issue consistently over a sufficiently long period of time so people understand how the system works and what the alternative is, eventually we will reach a point where people say it becomes a key political issue. People begin to understand the issue, that there is a viable sustainable alternative to the current banking system, the current money system specifically. And eventually mainstream parties will come round to the view that there's enough votes in this policy to actually take it on board and for it to become government policy.
Now, you've brought along with you a book, Modernising Money, by Andrew Jackson and Ben Dyson, with quite a nice little graphic on the front there of an ape slowly transmogrifying into what looks like a banker with a bowler hat on.
Yes. Now, or a civilised banker, yeah.
Oh, well, let's hope so.
We haven't got that far yet. But, I mean, we will get there eventually.
Okay, so tell us about the book.
Okay. Yeah, the book was written by Andrew Jackson and Ben Dyson, who are two key members of the Positive Money campaign. And it was written in collaboration with the New Economic Foundation, a lot of research that's done by the NEF. And basically what the book does is talk in very specific detail about how the current money system operates, how money is created at the moment, what a transition from the current money system would look like to the future system that we're suggesting, what the potential risks are, and how to preempt those risks in terms of how to actually put in place a real transition plan from the existing system to the new system. And it's a great read. It sounds very dry and esoteric, but it is actually quite readable, and it's been very well written, and it's available now.
For me, I mean, call me cynical, but I actually do believe that the economists, a lot of them who are sort of put in the public eye, many of them actually deliberately mislead people as to how the system works. And so something like this book is needed, definitely, if people want to understand how the system works. Would you agree with that?
I would, up to a point. I think that...
We're told, for example, the national economy is rather like, you know, your credit card, your private credit card. But it isn't, is
no,
it? I mean, you
not.
Know, it's completely different. You just explain, for example, puncture that myth for us, John.
Well, I mean, let's talk a bit about the way mainstream economics is taught in universities and has been taught in universities for the last 30 years, you know. I mean, it's certainly true to say that the Rand Corporation and various other vested interests in America who wanted to propel a certain view of economics through Harvard and through the major American universities basically took over the way in which economics was taught to a whole generation of economists over a period of 30, 40 years. And that's undoubtedly true. So I wouldn't be too hard on those economists who actually believe that they understand how the money system works. The reality is they don't, because they've been taught in a system which has told them complete myths about the way the money system actually operates.
I mean, for example, this whole business of printing money, which is now, they've found a new word for it, haven't they? Quantitative easing.
Yes.
For years and years, we were taught that that would never work. It's a terrible thing to do. And if you were to even contemplate it, you know, the markets would start shaking. And when you did it, everything would collapse. Well, it hasn't collapsed. No. What it has done is eaten into people's pensions massively.
Exactly.
But, I mean, there are certain parts of the way that economics is explained, which, you know, it annoys me. So I'm going to come back to this question. You know, puncture some of the myths and what you think of the way that economics is taught to the public. I mean, for example, through some of our news coverage, this kind of thing, you know, to actually get down to brass tacks.
Well, there are various myths about the size of... Let's take one myth, which is basically about the public public debt and about the size of the public sector. There's an idea that in order for any post-industrial society or modern economy to operate, there has to be a limit to the number of people who work in the public sector. So there has to be a limit to the amount of money we can spend on things like the National Health Service, or spend on education, or spend on social housing. And that there has to be an optimum limit. That is a myth. There is no specific number in terms of the scale
of what that economist would say, if I can play devil's advocate for a minute, is that you can only afford to run that public sector if you've got a private sector big enough that's being taxed to pay for it.
Yeah, but that's never been the case, and that certainly isn't true, because a lot of the activity in the public sector is actually creating employment and creating a virtuous circle or a virtual economic cycle. And if you look at this country after the war in 1945, for example, when we had absolutely no money in the economy, we were still able to create enough money at that stage to actually create the National Health Service, to actually re-establish a whole set of extraordinary social innovations in the economy. And we managed to do that without creating rampant inflation. We still had a stable economy through into the 50s and 60s to a large extent. You know, so it's simply not the case to say that we can't have the things that we want in terms of a decent health service, a decent integrated transport system, sensible provision for social housing. These are all things that we can have. But there is a very real sense, as you say, where this idea that economics, you know, there is no alternative, you know, this is a set of propaganda speak that's been created very carefully over a period of many years to actually make us believe that there is no alternative, and there always has been an alternative. And I think that's what's fascinating about this particular book. It tells us exactly what's the root cause of the problem, which is the way money is created and the way we can need to re-establish democratic control over money. It's our money. it isn't the bank's money, you know.
At what time then, because I mean this has happened at some point since World War II, did money stop actually serving the public and start becoming a sort of weight on our backs where we had to then think, oh crikey, I mean I'm not going to have enough money next week, how am I going to get some more? There's two sort of aspects to it. Money, you know, should be there just as a means of exchange, which helps and oils the wheels of an economy, but it's not that anymore, is it?
No, it's not that anymore. It's become something very different, which is basically a means of creating a vastly inflated financial sector, which is an enormous parasite that sits on the real economy. So if you look at the total amount of money in the financial sector and the number of transactions in the financial sector, it's now an enormous carbuncle, which is 20 or 50 or 100 times, depending on whose calculations you look at, the size of the real economy. And that's ridiculous, you know. So we do need to find ways and means of actually getting real money into the real economy. And what we're suggesting, what's been suggested in the book, is a system of what's called window guidance, which is a system that really existed in the 60s and 70s, which was really about a sort of guidance system for the amount of money that was being propelled into the economy, which was done almost on a gentleman's agreement with the banks in the 60s and 70s. And that agreement basically flew out of the window with the deregulation of the finance sector in the 70s and the 80s.
Well, now, you mentioned the Big Bang there, and we've had the death of Margaret Thatcher this week. Tell us a bit about what the Big Bang was, because this was a very important part of Conservative policy, along with all the other sort of social policies to do with really breaking the power of the trade unions and things like that. Yep. But the Big Bang, what was that and what effect did it have?
Well, the Big Bang was really an attempt to completely deregulate the finance sector and introduce a system of hands-off regulation of the way in which the finance sector operated. So it opened up the opportunity for the development of derivatives, for the development of complex Eurobond trading, for the development of secrecy locations, because of course the regulation in terms of where money was going and how it's being held.
This is things like tax havens and
tax havens, exactly.
Right. Because in the old days, before that, there used to be a sort of firewall around the country. You weren't able to take money in and out of Britain
absolutely
very easily.
Right. Absolutely right. You know, but if you look, the bad old days when you could only take 50 quid out if you're going on holiday, for example, you know, there was very, very rigorous, disciplined approach to the way in which money was managed within the economy. And we're not suggesting going back to any of those sort of draconian measures. We don't think that's necessary. But what we do think is necessary is to actually break the firewall, if you like, or create a real firewall between retail money, real money in the economy, and the machinations of the investment banking industry.
This is casino banking that is called,
exactly,
so-called, isn't
it? Yeah, which is having such a destructive effect on the global economy. And we've seen recently, you know, even Barclays have had to stop trading in food derivatives, for example, because there was such an uproar about the effect it was having on the global
food market. Well, this is the scary thing, isn't it, John, is that you've got people betting on starvation, basically making money out of the idea that, you know, that people are going to starve, or even making money out of war. You know, this kind of thing, betting on mass conflicts.
Yeah, absolutely right. And of course, that's been a long-standing tradition of the international investment banking industry, has been to, you know, invest in international war for generations, of course, and in the probability of it happening, you know.
Well, I suppose in a way that's a good way to finish, because you've concentrated our minds on, you know, on some of the issues where this really does hit home, and it's a dark, mysterious world, banking. I'll just remind listeners of the title. It's called Modernizing Money, Andrew Jackson and Ben Dyson. Just remind us about your name of your campaign again, John, and whereabouts people can find it.
The campaign is called Positive Money, and you can find it at www.positivemoney.org.uk.
Give us an idea just of how the campaign works briefly.
Well, the campaign is basically, you know, you can sign up and join in and collaborate in an effort to reform the way the money system actually operates. We've got something like 10 or 12,000 followers already now. So it's a growing campaign. There are a whole series of events taking place around the country. You can check out the website and see a whole series of videos and information on how the money system currently operates, which are all very entertaining and easy to watch. And you can participate by going to any Positive Money meeting event around the country.
John Long, thanks very much.
Pleasure. Thank you. Hush, 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 hush
93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hawkwind there with a song called Hassan e Saba off their album Quark, Strangeness and Charm. And I'm joined now by Paul Fernie. Hi, Paul, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony. How are you?
Now, in order to sort of do a bit of evocation here and try and bring the sun out, we're going to be talking about the sun. What is the sun?
Right, yeah, the sun is obviously our primary star in the solar system. It's composed primarily of the chemical elements hydrogen and helium. They account for 74.9 and 23.8% of, retrospectively, of the mass in the photosphere.
Hydrogen and helium, both gases, but the sun is not actually... Is it just a giant kind of ball of gas?
And that's effectively... Well, chemical elements is probably nearer. But yeah, it's effectively a ball of gas, is what the sun is. It also contains some heavier elements, which in astronomy are called metals, most abundant of which is oxygen at 1%, and then carbon, neon and iron. Yeah, so it's basically a ball of gas, and what... The principle of how it works is that the it's so massive that the gravity has drawn all this together and creates such high temperatures and pressures at the centre that you get thermonuclear reactions.
Right, now that is a nuclear weapon, isn't it? It's a sort of, yeah, thermonuclear weapon is a hydrogen bomb. So the sun is a giant, great hydrogen bomb going off constantly.
We could say that, though... As will come up shortly, there's not actually that much going on sort of inside it in terms of peak power production. But yeah, it's nuclear.
On the surface then, I suppose, isn't it really?
On the surface, the photosphere is not that hot. It's the corona that gets hot, and science still hasn't come up with a true explanation as to why it gets so hot. But basically, the sheer volume of heat produced by the sun is more down to its size rather than the amount of power production going on inside it.
Okay, so let's get back to origins. How was it formed in the first place, the sun?
The sun originated approximately 4.5 7 billion years ago.
Okay, you were there, were you?
No, not personally. Though I do have friends who were. And it came from the collapse of part of a giant molecular cloud of mostly hydrogen and helium.
Okay, so this is the idea being really that this is stuff which is, by force of gravity, is drawn together.
Yeah, absolutely. The universe, the galaxy, the galaxies are full of these clouds of gases, and what happens is that over time gravitational waves cause them to start collapsing in on themselves, and eventually when a large enough amount of this gas collects in one place, a star can be born from it, and that's where we get you can actually see stellar nurseries in the night sky if you've got telescopes. There is one in Orion's Sword which you can see, and you can see how basically these large collections of gas come together.
Okay, how much energy?
Right, yeah, approximately 4.26 million metric tons per second, which is 384.6 yottawatts, a yotta being 3.846 times 10 to the power of 26 watts. So that's 10 followed by 26 zeros, which is a huge number.
Right, so that's how much power is being given out by the sun.
It's equivalent to 9.192 times 10 to the power of 10 megatons of TNT per second.
Crikey, that sounds like a lot, yeah.
It is a lot
of
energy.
But it is a long way away, isn't it?
It is, yeah. It's one astronomical unit away. And that's how we sort of divide up the
solar
system.
That's an easy one, isn't it?
Yeah, one astronomical unit.
Because that's how an astronomical unit's based on.
Yes, absolutely, yeah. The mass is not destroyed, rather it's transformed into its energy equivalent.
This is Einstein, isn't it?
Yeah, this is physics and a chemical process that is probably too in-depth to go into.
Yeah, because it's actually a nuclear reaction rather than some sort of chemical reaction. So
that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, it's energy that is released through transforming the atom rather than through some kind of burning.
Two hydrogen atoms fuse together to form... a isotope of hydrogen plus one extra, which is shot off as energy.
Right.
Usually.
Okay. What happens in the end? How long is the sun going to last?
Right. Okay. Yeah. The sun won't explode as a supernova. So that's probably a good thing, because it just simply doesn't have the mass. However, it will enter its red giant phase in approximately 5.4 billion years' time. So we've got a little bit of time left. Though it's worth noting that in about billion years time, due to its ever increasing luminosity, it probably will actually by then have burnt away the atmosphere and all the water will have gone off Earth. So we've got about a billion years left.
Okay. Finally, sunspots. What about sunspots?
Sunspots. Yeah, that's an interest.
Is that the corona you were talking about earlier?
The sunspots occur on the photosphere, not in the corona. And current thinking behind that is that they're caused by the magnetic energy, because the sun is effectively a ball of liquid, What happens is that as it rotates, there is a difference in speed between the speed the pole rotates at and the speed the equator rotates at. And what it does is it twists magnetic fields. And these fields become so twisted that eventually the magnetic field lines snap back, and this creates a solar flare, which is what we see as solar flares.
Sunspots.
Sunspots.
Well, so, I mean, if you're looking at the sun directly, you'll see a spot, but if you're looking at it from the side, you'll see a flare rising up.
Yeah, you can, yeah. So sunspots are actually caused by the fact that the temperature where the spot is lower than the surrounding area.
Oh,
that's
right.
What actually shows us the dark, that's why it's a dark spot. So yeah, sunspots, but they're sort of another subject altogether.
Okay, well, Paul Fernie, thanks very much for enlightening us a bit more on astronomy.
Thanks very much, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, you listen to it and you think, no, it's not possible, but it is. US filmmaker Alan Frankovich made the definitive documentary for Channel 4 about the Lockerbie bombing. The Maltese double cross was never repeated, but can be watched online. It presents compelling evidence of a secret motive for the US CIA to blow up Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie on the 21st of December 1988. Alan Frankovich was interviewed in October 1982 by Alternative View in Austin, Texas, just after he released, in company business, his film all about the CIA.
The CIA's been on company business for years, so what's been its job in France, Italy, Guatemala, Iran, Cuba, and the Congo? And what does Colby know, and Agee, Jackson, Braden, Nixon, Marchetti, Helms, Bundy, Stockwell, Church? And what about Truman, Ike, Kennedy? The CIA's been on company business in stealth. Now, we find out.
Alan, do you have any insight into what kind of a person is in the CIA today? We talked about the earlier generation of people that thought they were doing good, fighting for democracy, freedom, etc., against communism. We've seen the disillusion of that generation. We've read their books, people like John Stockwell, Philip Agee. What kind of person is in the CIA today after all of these revelations of the evil that they've done all over the world? Is it sort of a cynical, careerist, opportunist?
Probably, but I think they're trying to recreate, you see, the consensus. And one of the reasons for having investigations was to create, yeah, that was in the past, we were doing those things, we're not doing them anymore. Because, as I said, and you know, a lot of people think they're under pressure to get a job, and so the CIA has been very active on campuses recruiting. And but the problem, you see, they're having, as I said, much of the world. I think if you mentioned 20 years ago the word CIA, nobody even knew what it meant. If you mention it today, people might not have a very clear sense of what it is, but they do know that the CIA had something to do perhaps with assassinating people, that it was involved in the coup in Chile. The things they might not know is that it's extensive operations of the trade union movement, it's extensive penetration of the American media, its use of religious groups even, and its continuing use of religious groups. But I think the kind of people they're looking for are the same kinds of people. They have to be people who believe in what they're doing, who are motivated. But I think in this case, some people are probably saying to themselves, well, it's a job like any other job, because a lot of it is pushing around paper and analyzing. You know, the CIA has a lot of intellectual people who do analyses of societies. Same thing you would do if you were a professor. And don't see any problem, because they don't have to face what's at the end of the line, because the CIA is the kind of organization that will, to accomplish many of its most vicious ends, it will be the command and control. It will hire local people because they're poor, you can buy them very cheaply, and the actual trigger pulling will be done. That might be the one difference between the CIA and, say, other secret police forces, is that the Americans have an American way of doing it, and they don't like to pull out the fingernails, you know. In other words, somebody else, just find somebody else to do it. And so you don't have to face the moral consequences.
That was US filmmaker Alan Frankovich speaking to the Austin, Texas VHS Video News Magazine. Remember those old VHS films? Alternative Views, way back in 1982. And more in coming weeks.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now I'm joined by Jason Yannakopoulos. Hi, Jason. Welcome to this week's dialogue.
Hello, Tony.
Hi. Now, what news have you got? You've got a waving a copy of Private Eye, as you normally do.
Yes. Now, there's a very interesting one in here about how about the Treasury George Osborne saying that those who make a living advising other people on aggressively on how to avoid taxes will not get away with it in this government, he says, not realising that some of the people he's appointed to high positions in the within the Treasury and indeed other associated boards have themselves previously been people who have been advising on tax dodging.
Right, so he's basically got tax dodgers at the heart of the Treasury. Yeah. Okay, so this explains a few things, doesn't it? Why there isn't really any heat on the Cabinet of Millionaires to bring their tax indeed out from tax havens. We had a massive leak as well, which was hardly reported in most of the mainstream press. The Guardian reported it. This was from the British Virgin Islands last week, over tax being kept there illegally, or money, yes, being kept there illegally. This is tax evasion, not tax avoidance, folks. Mm-hmm. Where you do have to actually declare what your assets are and where they are, and if you don't do that, that's tax evasion.
Indeed. And I mean, some of the people here who have been given new jobs is Ian Barlow, who ran KPMG's British tax practice has flogged some of the most aggressive tax schemes ever seen. He's been given the new job of being chairman of the board of Her Majesty's Revenue and Customs.
Oh, no. so he's a... Well, KPMG is an interesting bunch. I mean, these are the financial services firm. They used to have that massive office block down by Temple Mead Station, actually, on the roundabout there, the big roundabout that leads into Victoria Street. And I've noticed that the KPMG letters have come off of it. The entire building is empty. These were the guys who helped sign off the accounts for all the banks in the run-up to 2008 and said, oh, these banks are perfectly good, fine and healthy, and then they collapsed. So they're not very good auditors, are they?
Well, no, and it also says here that they'd had a round-the-world trust scheme for basically...
Oh, sorry, a what trust scheme?
A round-the-world tax...
Oh, right, around the world.
Basically just shifting money from tax haven. Another one was Paul Dayton, who was recently ennobled. He was a top banker for Goldman Sachs. He fought tooth and nail with the tax man over offshore trust schemes to dodge national insurance on its senior staff's bonuses. He is now George Osborne's commercial secretary.
Right, so these are all people who are experts in avoiding tax, and Osborne is surrounding himself. Does he actually, Jason, I mean, this might sound like a naive question, but does he realise that these people are all tax dodgers?
Well,
sorry, they aren't actually tax dodgers. They're people who make their living from advising people on tax.
Let's put it this way. He knows them somehow, doesn't he?
He hasn't really done much research on them then, possibly.
No, maybe not.
Well, the other thing to say, of course, is that the Bristol West MP, Stephen Williams, Lib Dem MP, he used to work for one of these firms. I think it's PricewaterhouseCoopers.
He did indeed.
Before he became an MP, he was an advisor on tax avoidance. Let's not say tax evasion, because it wasn't. It was how to avoid paying tax. This is exactly the sort of thing we're fed up with, like this people like Starbucks saying they don't make any money in Britain and make it all in Liechtenstein or Luxembourg or Andorra. Or one, maybe British Virgin Islands.
Yeah. The final person mentions in here, benefiting from a similar theme to what you just mentioned, a partner of management consultancy, PA Consulting, was Michael O'Higgins, and he is now, a couple of years ago, he was made the pensions regulator by George Osborne.
Right, so he's regulating pensions, but, I mean, isn't that actually... Can you see, is there some sort of logic to this, where he's making sure that the government isn't clawing back people's pensions if he's regulating pensions?
Well, he's the only one who wants his clawed back.
All right, Jason, anything else from Private Eye, or is that it this week?
Well, there is some interesting stuff followed on to the Leica Mobile with the multi-millionaire Subsagaran Ali Raja and his... Leica Group.
So, remind us of this story. Leica Mobile, how are they connected with, and is this part of government or what?
Well, they've been doing some fairly dodgy stuff in Europe. It's quite an interesting one, but here they've actually now fallen foul of the authorities, which is good to see. It's donated more than £400,000 to the Tories and have paid no corporations tax in the UK since 2007. The company's House of Registrar threatened to strike off and dissolve Leicatel UK, which sells cheap landline calls, and basically it threatened to strike off at the beginning of March accounts, because late accounts, basically they haven't been filling in their accounts.
They haven't been filing accounts. Well, they've been making money, but they haven't been
filing accounts. They've been making accounts, but paying no tax and not filing accounts, and finally the registrar's got onto them.
Oh, well, that's a bit of good news for a change.
That is a bit of good news for a change.
All right, Jason, thanks ever so much.
It's a pleasure, Tony.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Well, I'm joined by Jeff Sparks. Hi, Jeff. Welcome to Dialect.
Thank you, Tony. This is a What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 12th of April, there is a night of classic rock and metal featuring local Judas Priest tribute group Priest Unleashed, with support from Rough Cut and also Angels Fall at the front room of the Croft in Stokes Croft, Bristol. Entry is £4 on the door and doors open at 7 p.m. Also on 12th of April, John E. Vistick Experience will be performing at the Thunderbolts in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Hefner. This group formed in London in 1995 and were active from 1996 to 2002. In their career, they released 4 studio albums, several singles and several EPs. This is from the album We Love the City, and this is the song The Day That Thatcher Dies.
And sing all night.
Was Hefner with The Day That Thatcher Dies from the album We Love the City, which was released in 2000. Into Saturday, 13th of April, the rock covers group Straight Shooter will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Templegate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gigs should start around 9:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 14th of April, folk pop musician Melanie Payne will be performing at the Thecla at the Grove in Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 6:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 o'clock every Friday afternoon. If you're listening online, then you'll find us at dialectradio.co.uk. And there you can also subscribe to our RSS feed or an email list, which reminds you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. Thanks very much to this week's guests, John Long and Paul Fernie. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. As promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. So, until the same time next week, goodbye.
Friend.
Be on your way! This is my territory.
Your territory? What do you mean?
Wait a minute. It's you, the man from Maybury Hill.
Good heavens, the artillery man. I thought you surely burned.
I thought you surely drowned.
Have you seen any Martians?
Everywhere. We're done for, all right.
We can't just give up.
Of course we can't. It's now we've got to start fighting. Not against them, because we can't win. Now we've got to fight for survival. I reckon we can make it. I've got a plan. We're gonna build a whole new world for ourselves. Look. They clap eyes on us and we're dead, right? So we gotta make a new life where they'll never find us. You know where? Underground. You should see it down there. Hundreds of miles of drains. Sweet and clean now after the rain. Dark, quiet, safe. We can build houses and everything. Start again from scratch. And what's so bad about living underground, eh? It's not been so great living up here, if you want my opinion. Take a look around you at the world we've come to know. Does it seem to be much more than a crazy circus show? But maybe from the madness, something beautiful will grow in a brave new world. With just a handful of men, we'll start all over again, all over again, all over again, all over again. And hospitals and barracks right under their noses, right under their feet. Everything we need, banks, prisons and schools. We'll send scouting parties to collect books and stuff, and men like you will teach the kids, not poems and rubbish,
science so we can get everything working. We'll build villages and towns and we'll play each other at cricket. Listen, maybe one day we'll capture a fighting machine, eh? Learn how to make them ourselves and then... wallop! Our turn to do some wiping out. Whoosh with our heat ray. Whoosh! And them running and dying, beaten at their own game. Man on top! Our domination of the earth is fading fast, and out of the confusion the chance has come at last to build a better future from the ashes of the past in a brave new world. With just a handful of men, we'll start all over again. Is born in freedom, but he soon becomes a slave in cages of convention from the cradle to the grave. The weak fall by the wayside, but the strong will be saved in a brave new world. With just a handful of men, we'll start all over again. Trying to tell you what to be.